Welcome to the Apple Podcast. I'm here with Ray and Deirdre from Cooldea, an online marketplace where people can search and discover home furnishing products from across the web.
Hello.
Hello.
Good to be here.
Sitting in sunny Basingstoke at the Set Squared offices. We're going to talk a little bit about their journey to building Cooldea, what Cooldea is. So do you guys want to give a little bit of background on yourself?
Sure. I'll let Deirdre start on the time.
Yeah. So I suppose from my perspective, I have a background in law and I moved into investment banking and I was working very much with companies that were raising money, so leverage and acquisition financing. I suppose as part of that, I was lucky enough to save a little bit of money and purchase an apartment. And I suppose it was in the furnishing of that apartment that the business idea was really struck up. And always have loved interior design, and was really relishing the thought of sort of furnishing this apartment, but then was struggling to find the items that I want. So I knew them from Pinterest, from hotels, from restaurants, but then I couldn't actually find them within my budget, etc. And I was getting quite frustrated. Ray can cover that, but it was really going back to, why isn't there an aggregator? Light bulb moment. And I suppose that's really where the idea kicked off.
Yeah, I think it was. Actually, it's a really... a really interesting moment was that we were sort of discussing it, and then we took a weekend away, which was in May 2017. And during that weekend, we just started to write down our thoughts around, you know, what we would like to see, what we felt should be in market, what were the key frustrations that we had, and so on and so forth. And it's amazing we've kept the book and the sheets of paper that we actually wrote these ideas down on, but you know, the genesis of Cooldea really came from that, but it really was just fleshing out the key things that we thought were necessary. And then trying to turn that into something tangible, which is what we've done.
So before we go any further, we should let the listeners know, what is Cooldea and how did you come up with the name? That to me is quite fascinating.
So I think the easiest way to think of Cooldea, I like to think it's an easy business
so
to understand.
It so that's another one.
Cooldea.
Okay, it's Cooldea.
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 Yeah.
So it's a pun on cool idea.
Right.
And so I think we thought it was a cool idea, but also we wanted something that was a little bit more unique than maybe Skyscanner, which is what it says, what it does in the Thames type
thing. Sure, sure, sure.
So we wanted to build it up to be a brand in itself and to be respected and to be the unbiased sort of platform, which is informative and bringing, you know, the educational part to consumers as well as sort of the aggregation, sort of search engine part of it, which enables consumers to find the products from all of the retailers across the market.
So that's interesting. So you're not just selling products, but you are providing education. So what kind of education do people need in buying furniture?
Well, when I started out, I didn't know what an ottoman was. I thought this was something got to do with the Turkish Empire going back or a divan.
We did actually say that too. Once we were looking at a bed in Benson's for Beds and we said to the chap, so we need a bed. We have a small apartment. We need a bed that has storage within it. And he said, you need an ottoman bed. And I said to him, well, we don't need some kind of Turkish bed. What we need, he said, no, an ottoman bed has storage within it. But, you know, we'd like to think that we're two relatively educated people, but just lacked the knowledge of the key sort of things that we needed, which led into, okay, what kind of things can we pass on to other people that they might need to know in making decisions?
So there's that sort of educational part, the lingo, the new terms, but there's also, you know, the mistakes that you make when you buy things. So you buy a couch that's really too big for your space. So there's a lot around the considerations that, you know, hopefully people can read those and begin to think and incorporate those decisions before they make the purchase.
So that's an interesting one, because my cousin did that recently and I kind of wondered, how can you buy something too big? Because obviously you know the size of your room. And how do you end up buying something?
Because you look at it in a warehouse, you go into these big massive shops that are huge and everything looks in place. And well, I don't know if everybody does it, but a lot of people I've spoken to, the space in your head when you're not in it, it grows.
Right. I'll tell you something else that's interesting about that. So investigating the business opportunity, we spent a lot of time talking with people and understanding things that they had gone through and so on and so forth. And one of the things that we understood was like, it's a really emotive purchase to buy, say, a sofa or a bed. Like, you want something that's actually going to speak to people that come and stay at your place or visit your house about who you are. So quite often people will forget about their size constraints or their spatial constraints. And what they'll do is they'll say, no, I really, really love that. So I'm just going to try and make it work.
Right.
But then you realize that, you know, when you get it in there, that it doesn't work for one reason or another. And it's quite interesting because you need to sort of, or we felt like we need to give people a little bit of a leveler to say, you really need to think long and hard about this. because the implications are going to be on the space you have or how you get it in there or whatever.
Those are a couple of things that you mentioned. Obviously, the thing is too big for your room, obviously something that isn't, maybe doesn't fit in quite well with the rest of the apartment. What are the main issues that you see out there that you guys are trying to address with Kildare?
Good question, actually. I think the first issue is actually giving people a really simplistic way of searching for products. I think that's the first issue. And there are so many variables when you think about searching for furniture. So, you know, one variable that we've found in sort of going through the data side of what Kildare does is looking at the classification of colors. So, you know, one retailer might call a color one thing and another retailer might call it another. But to the consumer, you know, you want to know, is it red? Is it green? Is it yellow? What is it? So, you know, there are things like that that we've sort of noticed. So what we wanted to do was create a really simplified way of, you know, enabling people to be able to search the entire market to find products, but filter and apply things that are quite basic to most of us and say, well, I do want a gray sofa that's fabric, you know, that's this size roughly for my living space, and then find the relevant products. And like I say, do it in one place without having to go and do that 15 or 16 different times over and get disparate results. I think that's one of the key things that we're trying to achieve or trying to solve with the website.
So I guess quality would be another thing though, right? So is there only a certain set of vendors that you work with? I mean, do you curate the list of the companies that you're working with on the furniture piece?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I think what we want to do and achieve, so we don't actually sell the furniture on our site.
Sure.
We direct the consumer, once they've found the product, to go through to that retailer to do the purchase with them. They're in charge of deliveries, aftercare, etc. I think one of the main things is that we want to bring the breadth of choice to consumers, and then they make an informed decision. They can check out reviews, they can check out that retailer and decide if that quality suits them. Because quality, it's subjective. You know, it depends on your budget, it depends on your style. There's dining tables that you buy that you don't use day to day that, you know, you can have, you know, a more precious finish, but you know that you're going to be having your table mats down so it's protected, but that wouldn't suit for your day to day table. So we're not trying to decide for consumers. We're really about empowering consumers and showing them all of the options and letting them make the decisions.
So what you're trying to, so from what I understand then, is it's essentially, because the it's a crazy market, right? There's so many different vendors and boutique vendors and this, that, and the other. So essentially you're standardizing things like sizes, colors, the kind of the wording, the definitions around furniture, but also saying these are all the different things that you can have on offer, and this is different than pricing and delivery times, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a one-stop shop, really. Instead of you going out to 50 different, going out on a weekend, spending like a whole day in different department stores, you can actually say, okay, I like these three items and they're in three different stores. So I can go to those three stores on a weekend rather than going to 50 of them.
Exactly. And the other thing about it is like when you talk about, you know, the quality of the furniture and so on and so forth. So, you know, we do publish quite a bit of information about the retailers that feature on the website, but also you can run things like price filters. You might have preferred retailers that you actually want to look at specifically on the website.
Or retailers that you don't want to look at.
Or retailers you don't want to look at. So you can actually include or exclude them from your search when you're actually running it. So, you know, it's all about making it simpler for people. And then what we've found is that, you know, people will naturally start to gravitate towards different brands and styles and that kind of thing. So, you know, them becoming familiar with our platform will make it easier. But then they'll use the filters to their advantage to say, okay, I want to know, you know, who's offering products, who's offering coffee tables, for example. And actually, I want to look at these six retailers because they're my favorites. But rather than go to six different websites, just do it on ours and then you'll find what's on offer.
And there's one key point about that, because you can go to six different websites. If you know those six retailers, you can physically just go to each of those websites. But if you then want to start saving products, you have to set up six individual accounts. Mm. You need to remember the passwords for all of those. Or what I was doing is I was copying and pasting links into an email. And then I was trying to find, oh, which one link was that? Was it the third one? Was it the fourth one? So, you know, our share and favorite function, I think, is sort of transformational in that regard, because I can save, you know, seven dining tables down into the one link, into the one website with the one password. Then I can show them to Ray in the evening time. We can set sales alerts, and I don't have six different now new accounts that I need to manage, and I'm getting bombarded with emails if I don't want that.
So I remember when we first talked, you were talking about more advice for people when they're decorating rooms? So obviously you're simplifying the purchasing process and the decision-making process,
mm.
and you're educating them a little bit around the furniture. What's the next step then? So will you be giving advice, okay, you bought these three things, maybe they don't all go together, or you know, would you be doing that kind of interior design type work?
There's a little bit of work to be done around it. I think there are a number of different ways that can happen. So, you know, the first sort of step will be, you know, with the advice that we're offering, I think people don't necessarily just want to hear from us as Kuldea, although we are, you know, curating a lot of the content ourselves through, you know, the access we have, but we're also doing a lot of collaborations with you know, the retailers themselves, and also with interior designers and specialists in the field. So, you know, we're looking for a cross-section of advice to help people with that decision-making process. What we'd love, you know, ultimately going forward is to actually build in technology to it as well that helps make those recommendations for people. So these are things that we're looking at as options as well. But, you know, you don't want to take the human element of it to a certain extent. You want to keep that there. And I think that's why those collaborations are important.
So how do, obviously, the podcast is going to reach millions, but how do people find you? How do you engage with Kuldea?
In a number of different ways. I mean, you know, the first way really is, you know, engaging with us across social media to find us. So our social media following is growing quite significantly. Obviously, we want to be able to inspire people and tell them about our story and also showcase what's on the website. So we have an Instagram feed. We have a Facebook page. We actually have a community group within that Facebook page as well where people can join. And that's an exclusive group where it's actually a cross-section of people sharing ideas, their interior designer contributions and stuff. So we have those channels, Pinterest as well, where you can go and you can pull down products and designs, pin those, follow those, and then Twitter.
Can people show you what they've done with the things that they bought?
They can. Yeah, they can. So they can push them back up into the social channels as well. And then obviously, you know, we're doing a lot of front-end advertising and that kind of thing. So, you know, people will be able to find us or see us through, you know, just going through and doing search on things like Google. But then what you will see from us in a short space of time is a lot of collaborative sort of articles going out across publications in the interior design space. And with relevant sort of, you know, communications that are out there, really helping inform people. So, you know, our method of getting the word out there is to try and do it as organically as we can. We don't want to just go and blast the market with, you know, advertising, but at the same time, we know that we need to put the message out there, but we really want people to gravitate towards our product because it adds value to what they're doing, you know, and we know it adds value because that's the feedback we've had so far, and we use it ourselves too, which is probably step number one.
Definitely. Yeah. So talk a little bit about your journey. So you mentioned that this is something that you guys had worked on and thought out quite carefully. What have been the main challenges you faced as you've been trying to grow this business and build it?
Yeah, the challenges question is one that comes up a lot. And I always think it's a bit of a funny question because I suppose the challenge is whatever we're doing at the moment. You know, the challenge was at the beginning, sort of actually taking the risk and leaving the jobs. Then the challenge became building the site. Then the challenge was getting retailers on the site. And every time you achieve it, you forget how hard it was. So I suppose the way I see challenge and risk is very much, you know we have a certain number of things that are going to be, you know, difficult or challenging to do. But what I'm more concerned about is the things we haven't even thought about.
Correct.
The unknown unknowns.
So you've now just left your job, as you mentioned
yes.
just recently. So how was that step? And was it kind of a scary step?
Petrifying.
Yeah. So for people out there who are thinking, should I? Because there's a lot of the many people out there doing two jobs at the same time.
Yeah.
And obviously not feeling that they can necessarily progress the startup because they've got to do their day job. How do you?
Yeah, I think we were fortunate in that we've sort of tiered it. So Ray has left his job about 12 months ago and I continued to work and then I have just left. But frankly, it was really petrifying to leave and it's leaving that security of the paycheck coming in, something going into a pension and all of a sudden all that evaporates. But I think the thing that gave me the courage to do it was I believe in this idea and I think that we're going to be able to build something really special that's really going to help people in their journeys. It's sort of solving the issue I had. And when we speak to other people, it's an issue that everybody is facing. So I suppose it was having that belief that sort of gave me the courage to do it.
Mm, it's a good point. I think you need to at some point let go, like, and you can spend a lot of time and wasted energy thinking about things that you want to do and you want to achieve, and, you know, maybe even to a certain extent thinking about your job and going, God, I really want more and that kind of thing. But the only way you're going to get it is to actually take the step. And it is, I completely agree with Dee, it's petrifying when you've got this security blanket and something you've worked hard at for an extended period of time to let go. But, you know, fortune favors the brave, I guess. You know, you've got to go for it to a certain extent.
No risk, no reward.
Exactly,
I think.
Exactly.
I did a podcast just recently, actually, and the overriding piece of advice from that was never have a plan B. So you're going to go in full tilt, make sure, you know, have an emergency parachute, because then you're not really dedicating yourself full time into that.
Yeah, exactly.
I agree with that. But having the flexibility that you can continue to pivot, and that's really important as well, because how you see your plan A, even if you don't have a plan B, plan A doesn't happen as plan A is expected. So, you know, having that flexibility and that, you know, to be able to pivot is crucial.
You know, one thing that's really interesting from my own personal perspective is that there hasn't been a day where I've woken up and felt like, I don't know why I made this decision, like, or regretted making the decision. Like, and you know, you sort of indicate that to yourself that, you know, you've made the right decision to sort of push forward, whatever the outcome actually is, because you feel confident about you've done the right thing, you know, that you're taking on the challenge. And I suppose that, you know, that in itself is something quite empowering, that, you know, you've got the confidence in yourself to go and chase your dream or chase your idea or chase your goal. But yeah, I enjoyed my job that I had, but I haven't woken up one morning and thought, God, I wish I had that job back, you know, not for one second. So, you know, that for me is sort of liberating in itself.
So what experience, because you guys, I mean, you don't have a necessary furniture background or e-commerce background. So what in your past career has helped you? What have you taken? What have you used in the career that you've had so far to help you on this path to start from there and make it a success?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. I would say, well, from my own personal perspective, you know, I was working at quite a high level within an online SaaS business. It was in the B2B space. So I had a good understanding of the online space. I'm not a technical person in terms of a developer or anything like that, but I certainly understood the way that the space works and has moved and, you know, what the key sort of areas of success or failure might be. So that gave me a pretty good sort of grounding. But then having worked at a senior management level within that business as well, I really understood the business function. So, you know, what are the core requirements of actually structuring, budgeting, forecasting and driving a business? And that probably gave me a lot of confidence to be able to go out and do this because of that experience. They're probably the overriding things, I would say, Byron.
You saw you did a spreadsheet and saw the hockey stick graph and said, yes, this is going to do this.
Absolutely. There was a real light bulb moment, actually. I used to spend a lot of time working in the US. So my role was sort of global with what I was doing, but I spent a lot of time in the US, sort of half my time there, half my time in the UK. And I remember I was quite close to making the decision and I was still sort of sitting on the fence a little bit. And I started to look into the market in the US. And then that's where the hockey stick moment came, that actually, this is a real opportunity, not just in my localized area, but globally, that we could scale. And really, you'd be a fool not to go for it. And I remember I rang Dee as soon as that sort of light bulb moment occurred and said, look, we've been talking a lot. I think we're good to go here. And that was it. I resigned the next day.
So that's very interesting, because there's that always that debate. Should you follow it, start this business for money, or should you start it to solve a passion, something they were passionate about?
Yeah.
And I guess in a way you've kind of figured out a business that does both, really. But what advice would you give to someone who's looking to A, switch careers, but B, is thinking about, you know, starting up an e-commerce or online business, given that you've been through this now? It's been almost 2 years, right?
It's a year and a half. Since we first started. Yeah.
So all the knowledge you've accumulated over this time, what would you say to someone who's in your position as you were 12 months ago?
I think one thing that everybody tells us is don't do it for the money. All the advice that we got from all the people we spoke to is don't think exit, don't think anything like that. And I think, because we love this idea so much, and like, I absolutely love interior designs, it's what I've been looking at in magazines and everything for years and years, it genuinely, it's not about the money. It's not about that. It's actually sort of about building something that you can be super proud of in an area that you love. And that's why no day actually feels like you're going to work. It doesn't feel tedious because you love it so much. And okay, love will get you so far, but we believe in this. And from speaking with other people, and that's the other thing, I suppose, is soundboarded off other people, because you can get blinkered and think everything is rosy, but yet maybe it's not what people need. But if you genuinely believe it, like, go for it.
Yeah. I remember I got a piece of advice once from the guy I used to work for. And that was, you know, you can't beat the person that can't be moved, because that person will find a way. And you sort of feel like that is probably the biggest application. You've got to be pragmatic around, hey, you can't just be, you know, a rock that doesn't pivot. But at the same time, if you're making pragmatic decisions as you go and you're consciously seeing things that you need to negate or problems that are coming down the line and you're dealing with them, then you will be successful. But if your determination and belief is there, ultimately that's the main thing that you need to be successful. And that would be the one piece of advice, you know, I'd offer anybody, regardless of whether it's starting your own business or your own career. Like, just keep chasing your goal, keep chasing your dream.
I think when we started as well, and you tell people what you're doing, they see all the downsides, they see all the negative, they see all the risks. And that's good, because maybe you haven't thought of them all, and it's good if you can defend all those, you're in a pretty good spot. But it is having that belief that overrides all of, you know, the risks, and there's a lot of risk there. So having that sort of determination that despite all that, you're going to go for it.
Yeah, you guys are very pragmatic in that sense, right? So you understand what you've got yourself into and how you can get to where you want to get. So what is the next step for Kildare? What's in the process? What's in the plans?
There's a lot, Byrav.
You can tell us about.
Yeah, of course. We'll try and condense it down. So we've been live with our website for quite a few months now, and it's building traction, building up visitors through to the site, purchases, that kind of thing, building up retailer relationships. For us, I think there are a number of key things that we want to achieve. I think streamlining our processes is really key. Automation, absolutely critical. So, you know, we won't bore your listeners with all the facts around data and everything else, but we certainly have a real wealth of knowledge and understanding of those data sets now that we didn't have before. So we're working quite hard on really, you know, streamlining those and making those as efficient as we can, and introducing in other levels of technology that will help enhance that we've now become exposed to. And then that really sort of, you know, lends into, well, how do you improve the customer experience on your site? When I say customer experience, it's not just a consumer coming on and shopping on the site. It's actually, how can we improve the experience for a retailer and showcasing themselves to the consumer? So a huge amount of feedback coming in from users of the platform, researching, that kind of thing. And we really want to sort of bake that into the way that works on the site now. So people will have more elasticity or flexibility in their search, greater depth of products, more content from retailers around those specific products, reviews and ratings of those products. So all these types of things that really make it a more immersive experience. And I would say, you know, what's coming down the line, those two key things are coming down the line, and focused on really proving that concept in market, and then scale, you know, go big.
So you talk about data. So you're collecting much data on your customers as to the, you know, as to the kind of size of house they're trying to furnish or flat, whatever it is. And
yeah, we are. Yeah. We are. And then I think customer engagement is really, really crucial. So there's only so much data you can collect based on what people are doing on your site. But actually, the engagement, the dialogue you have with your customers is what makes you sticky, but it's also what makes you more powerful. So we've put in place some systems and procedures that allows us to do that. And that's what we want to do. You know, although we're an online platform, we want to build bonds with those people that are using the platform to look at how we improve it for them.
You know? So really not just being a kind of a pipeline for people looking for furniture, but actually advisory and, you know, going in and being more intelligent process.
We're very
bad. As we see how other customers, their journey, what products they look at, if they're looking down a certain track, for example, on grey sofas, you know, the other products that they have viewed will probably be quite similar. And then you can use that to help the people that are coming after them to sort of align their search and to narrow them down as quickly as possible. Because I suppose in today's world, you know, everybody is even more time pressure than ever. So you want to find the product that you can as easily as possible. So we're all about ease. It's really making the journey as simple as possible for the customer.
The other thing on that as well is if you're a retailer, I mean, you've only got as much data and insight as what occurs on your website or maybe online and offline, dependent upon your structure. And then any other intelligence you want outside of that, you've got to go and pay a significant rate for it. But we're capturing what's happening across the market. So, you know, we have real intelligence that we can offer back to those retailers as well to help them improve, you know, not just what happens on our site, but help them improve in general. And that's actually the goal of our business is, you know, it's actually helping improve the market. I mean, we've seen over the past 2 years in particular, a lot of change in the furniture e-commerce space. We've seen a lot of high street retailers really struggle. I mean, that doesn't just have to be furniture related. That could be anything from Debenhams to any other business that you've seen sort of go through CVAs and that kind of thing recently. So we sort of see part of our goal or part of our journey is to really help improve those efficiencies online for those retailers and make them successful, you know, bring relevant traffic and relevant buyers to them. So, you know, connecting those two dots is really crucial for us.
Sure. So we're sitting in the Set Squared offices in Basingstoke. Can you tell us a little bit about Set Squared? How did you guys get involved with it and what does it do? How does it help you?
Yeah, sure. So we became aware of Set Squared through a colleague that I used to work with, and he had also gone out and started a business. So he made us aware of it. And what they run initially to get you involved in the program is they run a two-day entrepreneurship course, and they invite you along. Well, you sort of apply, but then they come back to you and they'll give you an invitation if they think you've got a viable business idea. You'll go along to this two-day course. It's intensive. So what you'll work on is you'll work on your business model canvas and your customer canvas. And the idea behind it is that you get a greater understanding of what it is you're trying to achieve within your business. So just within the 2 days itself, you know, there was a lot of value there. On top of that, for the top rated businesses, so they have a panel that judges your sort of progression and a pitch that you do at the end. The top rated businesses within each of those courses then get offered a place within the Set Squared program. And there are about 250 businesses within Set Squared. We're based in Set Squared, Basingstoke, where there are about 40 mixture of businesses. It's, you get offered a place. And then within that, you have mentoring. So you have an entrepreneur in residence who works with you. They really help you evolve that business plan. They help you get a greater understanding of your customer, the steps you need to take. And you become part of a network of like-minded businesses who are in a similar situation. So, you know, that was, you know, entering the program, that was hugely enticing to us because I think one of the challenges that you face as a startup is you quite often can feel quite isolated and you're on your own. If you've worked in a company, you may have worked with 50, 100 people, and then all of a sudden you're on your own and you're making decisions and you don't have someone sitting next to you each day. You might have your dog sitting at home looking at you, wondering what's going on. And at times it can become quite lonely. So actually having this network and having the resource around it gives you some sounding boards. It gives you the opportunity to build contacts, collaborate on ideas, gather new ideas. And that's really been quite valuable from within Set Squared. That's essentially how the program works.
Right, so I've got a little bit of a cheeky question, which you feel free not to answer. But as a couple, how you found it actually starting the business together?
I think we're quite complementary in terms of our skill set and things like that. So where you're sort of the marketing and the tech background, you know, I've sort of legal, finance, and obviously the love of interior design and all of that. So I think that's quite good. We've definitely had some heated arguments in terms of differing opinions.
They're debates. They're not arguments.
Debates. Yes, indeed. But actually, do you know, as much as we both think that we are correct all of the time, when you actually have those debates, I think you get to the right decision. And, you know, I don't think either of us are so inflexible that we dig our heels in. So I actually think that despite how we might start out, we each sort of bring each other on a journey. So I think we're quite good at bringing out sort of the best of each other. But, you know, time will tell.
Well, actually, one thing that's interesting in the journey, and I think this has sort of set us in a really good place to where we are now, is that before we even moved ahead with the business, we actually sat down and said, okay, let's be really transparent around what our own personal goals are, our aspirations, and what our fears are as well. And just trying to get all that on the table so that we're both entering into this business, you know, as an engaged couple, with our eyes open. And we felt like that was really important. We still have that documentation as well. We're pretty good at keeping documentation. But, you know, we did that because we felt like it was really important to be so open about, you know, all the things that we may fear and stuff, so that the other person understood. So if you ever had a point of apprehension, it may be just a bone of contention around a business decision or something that we needed to, a challenge we needed to face, whatever it might be, you had a greater insight as to why the person may be feeling that way. And we felt that that was really important to do it from the get-go. And I think that's put us in a pretty good position now. And I don't ever think I've worked in a business where I haven't disagreed with other key decision makers. Sure. That's natural. And that's, you know, any business that says they don't have disagreements between people, well, I'd be wondering what's going on with that business. So they're always healthy debates.
What is it they say? When is the last time you've had a tough conversation?
Mm.
If it's not recent, you need to. You're not asking the right questions or doing the right things.
Exactly. Yeah.
Do you actually manage to do anything other than Cool Day? Or is it, have you managed to switch up?
we do, yeah. We've got a bit of a pack that we take at least half a day a week to go and do something different. So recently we've got into walking quite a bit, actually. We live in Southeast London and we've decided to explore some of the boroughs around London that, you know, having lived in the UK myself personally for 10 years, never been to these boroughs. So we've been getting out on some walking adventures and that kind of thing. And it's good for clearing the head and doing something different.
And we've got a wedding to plan. So, that's a distraction as well.
So last question. If you go back in time 20 years and talk to your younger self, what advice would you give yourself?
Well, we're very young at that point in time. Well, I was speaking for Dee, probably not myself. well,
that's 10 years then.
Yeah. No, I think 20 years is a good number.
It's a tough one. I suppose maybe from my perspective, I would say that, you know, that period from 20 to 30, don't get stuck. Don't sit in a job that you don't feel like you're learning. You don't feel like you're progressing. I think you really need to be the sponge at that stage and absorbing everything. And, you know, set really clear goals. What do you want from the job? If you get it after 2 years, like, leave. And I think people today move a lot more regularly. But don't move for the sake of moving. Sort of try and really think of what is your goal and how will each step sort of bring you on the path to achieve it.
Mm. Yeah, I would say, thinking back to when I was 18, I was always really interested in entrepreneurship. I actually did an entrepreneurship degree, one of the first ones in Australia, in fact, back about 20 years ago. And I remember being that age and looking at people that I knew who were older who had started businesses and stuff and thinking, God, those people are so much further ahead of me and I could never do that, or I'm going to have to spend a lot of time working in order to be good enough to be at that level. Where actually what you realize now in hindsight is, well, you could have actually been at that level, but you needed to put yourself in the mix. Like, you needed to be brave enough to do that and brave enough to make mistakes. And so I probably spent quite a bit of time in businesses where I was scared of making that mistake or scared of making that decision. And if I had my time again, I'd probably be a little bit more courageous and advise myself to just to get out there and do it, because that's the way that you learn.
Yeah, it's funny. Actually, I met some people recently that just dropped out of college. They dropped out in their final year and said, don't want to do this anymore. I'm going to start a business, and I've done quite well out of it, really. So, yeah.
Yeah.
It's never too late.
I think it's the no regrets.
Yeah.
Don't regret not doing something. That's never a good way to
Time is your greatest limitation around anything. And when you're young, I don't think you appreciate that enough. But now we get a little bit older and stuff, and maybe at times wish we were a little bit younger and moved a little bit quicker and that kind of thing. But I think you appreciate time a hell of a lot more. And yeah, I think when you're younger, if you had that realization, you'd probably move faster on making decisions. So
life's too short to do things you don't enjoy, right?
Agreed. Yeah. Agreed.
All right. Well, thanks for that. It's been very, very good, very informative. So thanks for having me here.
You're
more than welcome. Thank you for having us.
It is.
Thank you.